From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Homer's Iliad begins with the rage of Achilles, murderous, doomed rage, says the ancient epic, that ends in slaughter. A one-man performance of the Iliad retold for a modern audience explores that rage and its echoes down the centuries in wars from Troy to contemporary Afghanistan. It looks at war and the perpetual reemergence of war, at the fury that sweeps us toward it. This hour on Point, retelling the Iliad in 2013. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is there some of Achilles' fury in all our own lives? What makes us go again and again to war? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Dennis O'Hare, Tony Award-winning actor, acclaimed for his performances in Take Me Out and Sweet Charity, among many others. Also known for his performances on film and television, including playing the role of Vampire King Russell Eddington on HBO's True Blood. Now he's the star and co-creator, along with director Lisa Peterson, of the one-man show An Iliad, which just wrapped up a run at Art Emerson's Paramount Theater in Boston. The show will go on national and international tour starting this fall. Dennis O'Hare, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And thank you so much for your performances in Boston. I know you've done this all over, but I happened to catch it over the weekend, and it's just terrific, very moving. The house was on its feet as you wrapped up in Boston. So congratulations on a wonderful performance as well.
Thank you. We really had a great time. You know, we planned on coming to Boston a long time ago, and we had no notion that what would occur in Boston would happen. And so we were a little worried about coming into Boston with our tale of violence and death and mayhem. But it felt like it was a necessary sort of reflection, and the audiences really, really appreciated it. I got a chance to talk to a lot of people afterward, and people said it was a great thing to sort of dwell on and think about, especially in light of what had happened in Boston.
That is, coming in right after the Marathon bombings. Marathon, another Greek reference right there. I had the feeling it was doubly appreciated before that. People kind of wanting and needing to want more search around our human souls, try and figure this out. For those who haven't seen it at all, it's an incredibly spare stage, as spare as you will ever get, not even a back curtain, just right through to all the stuff, the lights and ladders at the back of the theater, just you and a suitcase and once in a while a chair and a table, and a little later on in the performance, a wonderful bass out on stage being played to back you up.
Yeah, and Brian Ellingson, a fantastic musician.
Fantastic. Hats off to him, too. He really makes it great. And there you stand with the weight of this tremendous epic on your shoulder as an actor. You start off in a great coat and maybe putting on the garment of the storyteller. Are you Homer? Are you Homerish? Are you Homeric? What are you as you stand there alone preparing to deliver this to us?
I'm scared is what I am. I'm terrified. You know, Lisa and I spent about 5 or 6 years developing this piece. And before I did it, I had the pleasure of watching other actors do it and sort of explore it. A lovely actor named Hans Altwies out in Seattle, and a lovely actor named Tim Kaine, who did it in Chicago with great acclaim, and then my colleague Stephen Spinella. And so we have this idea that the coat is Homer. And any actor who has the nerve and the memory and the stamina to put the coat on becomes Homer. And in fact, Lisa and I have developed a sort of weird repertory company of two people. We call it Homer's Coat. It's our little company. Yeah. But we're quite serious about what we mean by that. Who knows if there is a Homer? The scholars still debate that. Was there an actual one person named Homer? Mm-hmm. There certainly were bards and people who were in the tradition of telling that story, the story of the Trojan War. And those people, we believe, were collectively Homer. And so we feel like we are Homer. And as we wrote the play, we call the man the poet. Mm-hmm. But in my mind, it's very much Homer. And our conceit, which helps propel the play, I think, is that Homer has been alive since that initial telling. And he's sort of, in a Beckettian sense, doomed in this alternate universe to continue telling the story. And he's whisked and transported to different spots in history where it's needed. By whom? I don't know. By the gods? Mm. By necessity? But he arrives and he lands, literally, in this dark space and lifts his head up and begins to intone, only to realize that, oh, I'm in a place called Boston.
But here we go again with this story. He's a time traveler, or he's the eternal storyteller. I think you're prepared. I think you'll be good enough to share with us a little, if you can slip into the voice of your narrator here. He talks about how long he's been telling this story, how again and again it's felt current and necessary, but it's a burden too. Could you jump into character for a minute?
I'll just start at the beginning, yeah. Man in the yadete ya, pala yadio achilaus, ulo menen hemuriakaios, alge eteke polas diptimus psuchas, aidi proiapsen hero. Back then, I could sing it for days and nights, on and on, every battle, every old aggression. I would sing and sing. In Mycenae once, I sang for a year. Yeah, you don't believe me. In Babylon, I sang it differently, but the crowds came. In Alexandria, I started to notice a few empty seats. Still, I sang it. Shorter, though. 3 or 4 days. Yeah. You know where it went down really well? Gaul. Yeah. Something about those people. They had a real taste for it. They used to get up on tables, sing along, threaten to take the whole thing over, went outside screaming, building fires. Terrible. Every time I sing the song, I hope it's the last time.
Dennis O'Hare, reciting, performing from very early, starting off there with some ancient Greek, I think, in Iliad. In the audience, we think we have an idea why you hope it's the last time, but we don't know the half of it. By the time you're done here, this storyteller demonstrates why he doesn't want to tell this again and again, and yet he does, and yet almost has to. But the burden of the passions and the rage at the heart of this story is almost too much to bear.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I felt gratitude to you, but it was one of those moments when you feel the actor's burden. It's physical, it's spiritual, and it just cuts right to the heart.
Well, and I'll tell you, for us, you know, all of us who've done it, all the other actors in our little company, also Henry Warwitz, a fantastic actor in the West Coast, and is that, you know, you're channeling in a way. You're channeling the characters. You're channeling Helen. You're channeling Hector and Achilles and Thetis and Hephaestus and Apollo and Zeus and Agamemnon and Odysseus. And so you're, in a strange way, you step outside of yourself and let them come through you. It's only in thinking about what the thing is going to be that you get tired. And there's a great moment at one point where he turns to the audience and he says, "Have you ever seen a front line?" Because he wants to describe to them what it looked like with Hector.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm prepared, by the way, for someone to say yes, because there are going to be veterans out there who have experienced war in a way I haven't. And we're quite prepared for that. We want that. Normally, however, the audiences don't respond. And then he goes on to tell them. He says, "Well, let me show you what that looks like. I've got a photograph here." And he tries to find it and he can't find it. And then he pulls out his hand and he just shows them a blank hand and says, "Well, here, outside the trenches where there had been a particularly bad day, and this is 100 years ago or so, but when you look at this field, you just see all these bodies." And the point being is that we're trying to figure out how do you make an audience who especially – we're disconnected from war in a visceral sense. We certainly get images of war all the time.
All
we're
the
bombarded
time.
With it. It's not like we don't know what it looks like. But that's a very different thing from walking across a field that people did in World War I and seeing just bodies littered everywhere. Think about the effect it had on people like, you know, Alfred Sassoon, or Sassoon, the poet, mm-hmm. and Alfred Owens, the other great British poet, World War One. It fundamentally shattered these guys' psyches, that being in that close proximity to constant death and dying. It does something to you. And we're just meditating on that in a way. And as I said, we let our character speak for us many times, and only once in a while does the poet have to take on that burden. But one of his particular burdens is he knew these boys. So he spent time in history. He's lived since the Trojan War. He's sat with them, eaten with them, consorted with them, hidden with them, and watched
boys
them
from
die.
All over ancient Greece, and you cite the towns they came from, and you then begin to intermix it with towns out of the United States as if these were boys who were headed off to Iraq, and these days women as well, girls as well, head off to Afghanistan, Iraq.
Exactly. I'll give you a little piece of that. He starts out.
We're right up against the break.
We'll come back.
Okay, we will. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the human weakness for war in Homer's Iliad and in a retold Iliad for the contemporary stage, a one-man show that we are all somehow part of. It is an Iliad. Dennis O'Hara is with us, actor, performs it, also co-creator with Lisa Peterson, who directs it. It's headed out on national and international tour later this year, just wrapped up in Boston over the weekend. He joins us today, Dennis O'Hare does, from New York, and you can join us as well. Why do we go to war again and again? Are we so different from Achilles and Hector and Agamemnon and Priam in our pride, our anger? And have you seen Dennis O'Hare do his Iliad on stage? Dennis, we have quite a few who have. Maureen says Dennis O'Hare was amazing. Matthew says, astonishing bravura, one of the most bravura performances I've ever seen on the stage. Vandermeer, we were wowed by the performance when it was in New York. You've got your fans out there.
That's so kind.
Yeah. And you've got your list of young men hit off there. It's a big list. Give us just a taste of how he's sort of reminding us that these are real boys headed out to real war.
Well, what we, you know, it's funny the way we started working on this piece, and we thought about what do we have the authority to tell the story? You feel daunted and small in the face of the story. And then we kept thinking, you know, well, this story is relevant. But when people hear things like the list of ships, which is a very famous passage in the Iliad, which goes
many ships.
Massive. Yeah. And we thought, well, what is he doing? Why is Homer doing this? And we thought, he's doing it because his audience, as he sat there in his various, you know, he would run around the Greek islands telling these stories. Yeah. They would nod their heads and whoop and call out when they named
applaud.
Their island.
That's our town. That's our ship. Woohoo!
Yay, Boeotia! Woohoo! Yeah. Sick ladies, go. So we thought, that's the same thing with us. We have pride. We have local pride, national pride. And how do we make the audience complicit that they're just not watching the show passively, but that a name is said and it hits their chest and they go, oh, my God. So I'll just give you a little bit of the Greek, and then we go into the English. And so he says, it's coming back to me now. Fighters from Cornea, Haliartus deep in meadow, and the men who held Plataea and lived in Glissus, men who held the rough-hewn gates of lower Thebes, on Kistis the holy, Poseidon's sun-filled grove, men from the town of Arne, green with vineyard. Oh, that's right. You don't know these places. But these names mean something to me. And I knew these boys. Well, the point is, on all these ships are boys from every small town in Ohio, from farmlands, from fishing villages, the boys of South Dakota and Nebraska, the twangy boys of Memphis, the boys of San Diego, Palo Alto, Berkeley, Antelope Valley. You can imagine. There are soldiers from Kansas, from Lawrence, Kansas, from Springfield, Illinois, Springfield, Massachusetts, Worcester, Mass., Quincy, West, Southie. You have soldiers from Cooperstown, New York, Buffalo, New York, Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, the Bronx, the South Bronx. You have soldiers from Florida, from the Panhandle with its snake charmers and evangelists, from the Okeechobee. You have soldiers from Miami who speak Spanish, Miami who speak French, Miami who speak English. You have Puerto Rican soldiers. You have soldiers from Texas, from the Flatlands, from Plano, from Houston, from Dallas, from Tennessee, from Western Tennessee, the mountains in Seattle, the mountains in Virginia, Flint, Michigan, Benton Harbor, from the Thumb, Escanaba. That's it. That's it. You get the point.
All over. And suddenly we're all in it because we are all in it. There's almost no escape from it, as you tell us.
Well, we do a weird thing. We try to tailor it to our audience a little bit. So we went to Boston. We asked people what town should we name, and people told us. Springfield. There's a Springfield in every state, sure. I think. So that's an easy in. But then we thought, someone said, well, Quincy, and someone else said Worcester, and then someone said, oh, we got to say Southie. So we cut out some Illinois towns. We cut out Evanston and Chicago, unfortunately, for this version.
But you've still got Springfield, the twangy boys of Memphis and the boys of Springfield, Illinois. Dennis O'Hara of Ann Iliot is with us. Dennis, we've got Jackie calling from Springfield, Illinois right now.
Oh, wow.
Let's go to her. Jackie, you're on the air with Dennis O'Hara. Thank you very much for calling, Jackie.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to speak to that large question about why is it that we always go to war?
Yes.
My fiancé was killed in the Vietnam War, and my husband is a Vietnam War veteran. Mm. And I recognized, even at the tender age of 18, that this is going to go on for each generation. This means that there's going to be a war when my sons are ready for are at that age. And I wanted to search for why. Why is it that every generation has to have some kind of conflict? And the answer is because we are not getting in contact, contacting our deeper spiritual needs. And as we take care of those needs, there's a space where, no, we don't want to go to war because it's not something we want to engage in.
Do you have hope that we, the great collective we, can ever get in touch enough with that those spiritual needs, Jackie, that we would somehow escape this cycle of war?
Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. I wish it would happen. I know that everybody everywhere always asks the same questions. Mm-hmm. Why are we here? Where are we going? Why are we doing this? And those answers are a spiritual answer and understanding that spirituality. And it takes us above this carnal war thing.
Jackie, you've lived it. I so appreciate your call.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. I mean, Dennis, what about Homer? How do you read him? These days we're all connoisseurs of editorial leanings.
Yeah.
What would Homer say to Jackie about her observation there?
A Homer would smile sadly and shake his head and probably tell you a story. And he would tell you the story of Hector and Achilles, because Hector didn't have a dog in this fight, to put it bluntly.
Well, he had an army at his door.
Yeah, but his idiot brother Paris went off and stole Helen from Menelaus and brought her back.
Yeah.
And the Greeks came to Troy and asked for Helen back, and the Trojans said no. And then the Greeks felt compelled and they felt insulted enough to gather an army. And then we have Achilles, who also doesn't have a dog in this fight. He didn't need to do this war. He was not part of the pact with Menelaus and with Agamemnon to defend Greece. He came along because he's a mercenary. But he had no emotional stake in the fight, and he even says at one point to Agamemnon, we all followed you to please you, to fight for you. The Trojans never did me damage, not in the least. And Hector, at one point, castigates his brother and basically says, why are we doing this? We're doing this because of you, idiot. Of course, the backstory before that was that Ilion, Troy, was insulted earlier and was raided and burned to the ground by earlier Greeks before Priam was king. And you can continually go back to an insult, a slight, a war, an action that is used to justify the next slight, war, insult, or action. And as our poet says at one point, he says, the Greeks have stolen Helen, the Trojans have stolen Helen, and the Greeks have to get her back. And then he sighs and he says, it's always something, isn't it? Because that's the truth. It's always something. And everyone's something is justifiable. And their reason is absolutely pure, vital, and justified. Everyone has that justified reason.
The justified reason, but it comes down to rage. I mean, you say, Achilles had no emotional stake in the war, but that doesn't keep him in the Iliad from reaching incredible depths or heights of rage.
No.
Which you bring to us.
Well, it's funny because Achilles' rage is not directed at the Trojans. It's directed at Agamemnon, his commander. And it's directed at Agamemnon because Agamemnon insults him and humiliates him and steals his prized woman, Briseis.
Yeah.
And so Achilles says, well, fine, I'm not going to fight for you. And he allows his countrymen, the Greeks, to be slaughtered left and right because he refuses to fight because of a personal insult that was visited upon him from Agamemnon. It's these layers of alliances and arguments within that's so interesting about the Iliad.
Give us just that little bit of Achilles on anger, the gall swarming
it's
in people's
fascinating.
Chests.
Of all people, here is Achilles, the great warrior, and this is after Patroclus has been killed, and Achilles is
a great friend, you know.
Absolutely devastated, and he cries out to his mother, who is a sea nymph, Thetis. She lives in the sea, and he sits at the edge of the ocean and cries for her, and she comes. And he says, if only strife would die from the lives of gods and men, and anger that causes the sanest man to flare in outrage, bitter gall, sweeter than streams of dripping honey that swarms in people's chests and blinds like smoke, just like the anger Agamemnon, king of men, has roused within me now. Enough. Let bygones be bygones. Done is done. Now I'll go and meet that murderer head on, that Hector that destroyed the dearest life I know.
And rage comes aplenty in Iliad. Dennis O'Hare reciting there. Brian in Worcester, Massachusetts, the aforementioned as well. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks so much, Tom, for taking the call.
Yes.
I just want to mention the fact that my grandfather, who was in the Navy and during World War II, and myself, I'm currently active duty military, and I've been to war. I think this interpretation brought a lot to light for us, you know, sitting back 70 years separated in our, you know, our wartime experiences. Just thinking that we may not always want to go to war, that sometimes in the time, you know, just with the Iliad and Homer, that it was a lot of people that went to arms because their nation was at stake, or it was, a, you know, a common goal for the country. I don't think that's changed.
Did you see Dennis perform an Iliad, Brian?
No, I was unable to. Deployment schedules aren't too great for, but we heard audio. You know, we were able to sit there and listen to the interpretation.
Yes, yes. Oh, I'm so glad you call with that. I mean, there's that national call, and young men and now women as well respond to it, Dennis. But your storyteller, your poet, is just almost, by the end of this, almost ground into the dirt by the weight of that and the suffering that it brings over century after century.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Lisa and I, when we developed this piece, we came from the same place but a little bit of different motivations. Lisa was looking for a response to what was happening currently, this is in 2005, to Afghanistan and Iraq, and was looking for literature and plays that were talking about this experience and really wasn't finding them, and so was directed toward the Iliad by a great friend of ours, Morgan Jeunesse, who's a dramaturg who claims that the Iliad is the first play. So we went and looked at it, and we early on, of course, lighted on the idea that this is that war is a waste. And what I mean by that is that it wastes resources. It wastes human resources and physical resources, land, animals, children, women. But Lisa's point was probably more general but also more philosophical. And her point was, however, within mankind there is violence and there is this rage, this inchoate drive toward rage. And so our play is sort of a twinning of those themes. Neither one of them is and by the way, we provide no answers. I don't think Homer provides an answer. He provides a reflection of culture. And what we hope to do is to provide a reflection of culture. It's not always a pleasant task.
As you do it again and again, have you come to some answer inside about the origins, the roots of that rage? What is that that ultimately gets tapped, even in those who start out saying, no, it's not for me, I'm not into it.
Right.
But then finally you show it flaring and blossoming so terribly.
Yeah.
What is
our
that?
Our poet. Well, I don't have a good answer, unfortunately, and I think if I did, it would be glib. All I can say is that there's a fantastic Roman playwright, Terence, said, nothing human is alien to me. And I think the beginning of any solution comes in compassion and recognition, that we recognize what we are, who we are, and only in that can we attempt to better ourselves. You know, I've been accused of being anti-war. I have no problem being called anti-war. I find there's nothing wrong with being anti-war. This is not to say that there are – that every war is unnecessary. I'm not going to sit here and defend the notion that we shouldn't have had an action in World War II. That felt necessary. The problem is every war feels necessary. We'll find a spokesman for every single war. And in the meantime, what happens is people die. Lots of people die. Mm-hmm. And civilians die. Lots of civilians die. It's not just the soldiers dying. It's the women of Troy who are kidnapped and raped and taken back to Greece. It's Hector's infant son thrown from the battlements. Mm-hmm. It's Cassandra taken in chains. I mean, this is not a new or old phenomenon. This continues to happen. There's more than just the soldiers who are involved in war, unfortunately.
Unto this very moment, you've got Syria, and we're not talking ancient
exactly.
Syria right there in your recitation. May in Lexington, Kentucky. May, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Great show. Great subject. Dennis, you're brilliant.
Thank you.
I'm no Homeric scholar, and certainly I'm no philosopher either, but I think we are fools to forget that we're animals, physiologically.
Yeah, that's true. And,
you know, the fight or flight, the warrior gene, half of us have it, the rest of us don't. I think there's, you know, like Homer and you just said, there is no answer to why do we do this, but the unmedicated Homo sapien, you know, experiences anger and defensive responses, so... I think that this will go on forever as long as we're humans. And I agree with you, there's no shame in being anti-war, but if you've lost someone in a war or if you're in a war-torn country, mm-hmm. Those horrible feelings come up in people you love, and they go to war and they die.
Yeah.
So I think it's great you're doing what you're doing, and gee whiz, I wish the nuns had made it this interesting. I went to school in Boston, and we actually translated Iliad from the Latin way back, you know, 40 years ago now. But
wow.
But it's great. I had to call. I never call, but this was such a great show, I had to call. So keep it up.
May, thank you. Thank you.
You know, one of our contemporary examples about rage is road rage, and we have a section where, you know, we're talking Patroclus, and suddenly it shifts, the light shift, and the poet is slammed up against a wall. In this version, we didn't have a wall, so we just did a spotlight, and he says, I can't say it all because we have some language in there that's not appropriate for radio, but he basically says, you know, that moment you can kill somebody. You could kill them right then and there. You could rip their head off. You could tear them, rend them limb from limb. The guy in front of you who cuts you off. You could ram him with your car. You could ram him. And you don't care about the results. Just ram him. And you can see the smoking metal, and you can see the charred thing, and you can see the airbag, and you hope the airbag smothers him. And if it doesn't, you'll get out and you go, you idiot, why did you cut me off?
May says we're animals. I think we may be worse. I mean, we use our intellect to what? To collect and savor and almost compress and build these emotions even bigger than they might need to be. You've got it right there in road rage.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the human weakness for war in Homer's Iliad and in a retold Iliad for the contemporary stage, a one-man show that we are all somehow part of, even now in 2013. Dennis O'Hara is with us, co-creator and star of An Iliad. Just ended a run at the Paramount, Arch Emerson's Paramount Theater in Boston, headed out around the country. You'll see it in L.A. and Scottsdale and Purchase, New York, and more later this year. Dennis O'Hara, of course, Tony Award-winning stage actor, acclaimed for performances in Take Me Out and Sweet Charity and in HBO's True Blood. Dennis, it's a privilege to have you here. I want to get a little bit more of the sound of this performance. If you would take us to the death of Patroclus. Achilles refuses to fight. He puts on Achilles' armor. He goes into the battlefield. Just the sight of Achilles' armor for a while sends the Trojans reeling, but his time comes. Could you take us there?
Yeah. Patroclus does quite well for a while, and he's killing a lot of people, and And ultimately, it catches up with them in a strange way. And this is one of our hooks. Lisa and I were fascinated by this. What it says in the Iliad is that his helmet falls off and his armor falls off. And so this is the section we're going to talk about. And then in the middle of it, like, I've never quite understood what happened. His helmet falls off. Some of his armor falls off. He suddenly gets shoved to the ground like some massive force hit him. Something hit him. The helmet didn't fit anyway. The armor didn't fit anyway. Like, to even put it on, he had to stuff rags in his head and rags in his chest just to keep the thing on. It's not his armor. It's Achilles' armor. Achilles has like 400 pounds on him, whatever it is. So, you know, after all this struggling, Patroclus has lost his helmet. He's lost his armor. And, I mean, at the time, you know, what some people said was that Apollo knocked it off him. Apollo was on Hector's side. And Apollo just went like this. Just came up behind him and went with his little finger and his helmet. And then Apollo kind of went. And the straps broke on the breastplate and it fell to the ground. And Patroclus stands up and he goes, totally exposed. And then, out of nowhere comes this Dardan, this guy, never fought before. First day of fighting, done very well, running around. He's killed like 9 people. He's knocked like 5 charioteers off their things. He takes his spear and he literally just happens to be behind Patroclus. And he just kind of goes, oh, right through him. Patroclus, like he didn't even feel a thing, just turns around and goes, oh. And he sees this kid, this Dardan. And the Dardan takes his spear, pulls it back out, and runs away. Then Patroclus, the end of life came blazing up before you. Hector.
From armored and mighty to vulnerable and so frail. Yeah. Dennis O'Hare there from an Iliad. And Judy's writing to us online, and she says, if anyone can make it resonate, it's the great Dennis O'Hare, truly one of our great actors in every medium. Is there anything he cannot do? Matthew is calling right here from Boston. Matthew, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Dennis.
Hi, Matthew.
An Iliad was absolutely thrilling, and I've, as an actor myself, I've admired your work for years. I saw you in Take Me Out and American Horror Story and so forth.
Thank you.
And you were kind enough to chat with me a little bit after a show last week, and you said something that was really interesting, Dennis, and I wonder if you could expand on it. You mentioned that your approach as an actor is that everything in the text is performative, and I just found that statement just fascinating. I wonder if you could expand a little bit on that and talk about how you approach a text, whether it's this text in an Iliad or something else.
Thank you for that. It was lovely talking to you. I went to Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, and they have a pretty fantastic theater department. And there's 2 areas of study there, and one is pretty much straight-up acting theater, and the other was called the art of interpretation, or interpretation, which is now called performance studies. And in interpretation, taught by people like Paul Edwards and Frank Galati and Lilla Heston and Lee Roloff, anything can be performed, poetry, Shakespeare, the phone book, anything. I remember performing Shirley Jackson's short story, The Witch, for a lovely guy named Dwight Conkergood, one of our professors. I also did poetry with Lilla Heston. I remember doing E.E. Cummings' poem. So I was sort of trained as a young mind that you don't necessarily have to perform just plays. Anything, any text is performative. And that includes stage directions. You know, at one point we have in our Iliad, he's in his frenzy and he says, impaled. And then we have in stage directions the word M-O-R-E, more. And we mean that to be performed. It's like a little urging, a subconscious urging. And so the poet says, impaled, more, stabbed, more, whipped, more, snapped, chopped, hewed, smashed, hacked. And I just love that we got to include that parenthetical acting.
Anything can be performative. Well, this certainly can in your hands. Matthew, I appreciate your call. Marilyn in Newton, Massachusetts. Marilyn, you're on with Dennis O'Hare.
Hello. Thank you very much. Sounds marvelous, and I hope someday I'll see it. I have 3 quick points that haven't been discussed. The first is that men make war. Women get angry, but and Queen Elizabeth and Queen and Catherine the Great, etc., made war, but Victoria did, but I don't think that they felt enraged. The second is that men are sent to boot camps and taught carefully how to desensitize themselves and feel rage so that they can kill people whom they don't even know. We know that that happened in the last couple of wars that we've had. And the last one is, it's always struck me that on the one hand, you have men who really don't want to go to war. They're the men who said in the Second World War, hell no, we won't go. Mm. We had thousands of young men trying to get out of the Vietnam War, and they were punished for it. At the same time that when the bodies are returned, the honor that is afforded death always strikes me as being something where I personally feel both amazement and shame. So,
Marilyn, you raised so much. May I ask you one thing, Marilyn? Is it different now? A young friend of mine went into the Army not long ago at boot camp. One of the first things he had to do was fight with other young men and young women there. New recruits to the U.S. Army, fighting literally fighting across gender lines. Is it? I mean, women go to boot camp now too, Marilyn.
I agree, Tom, and I thought of that, but many of those women go because our economy forces them to go. Some of them may, in fact, have found an outlet for rage that was never afforded before. So I think that that's an important question.
Yeah, yeah. We'll pick it up. I appreciate your call. Dennis, Cynthia Rose writes as well. She says, along those lines, if we're honestly to look at the whys of war, we must finally discuss gender. Exceptions, yeah, well, yes, to everything, but only half of us are engaging in this activity. Well,
you know, we have a great scene between Andromache and Hector. Hector comes back to his wife, and she has a lime. She's holding the baby, Astyanax, and she says, "Is the war over?" And he says, "No, it's a bad day for us." And she says, "Oh, Hector, I'm begging you. You're all I have left. Achilles killed my father, my mother, my brothers. Now I have only you and our dear child. Please, stay on the ramparts. Why can't you draw your men up at a fig tree down there where the gate is weakest?" And he says, "But that would make me look like a coward. I can't retreat." And in that one little interchange, we have those two points of views. We have the woman with the baby saying, "Would you please stay home with me?" And it's a fantastic monologue she has late, which we had to cut, unfortunately, where she talks about, you know, even if your boy survives this war, he's going to be an orphan, and he'll wander the tables and take the leavings from the generals as they drop their food at his feet, and he'll be laughed at and said, "Oh, look, there's Hector's orphan son."
Gee. Marilyn says women know anger too, and of course they do. I mean, maybe rage as well, and why wouldn't they? But still I wonder about this rage that's at the heart that goes even to war. I mean, you've recited this again and again. Do we know that rage because, I don't know, the world is flawed and our human minds are capable of seeing something better? They're angry that it's not better. They're angry that it's not what we can picture. Is our intelligence somehow wrapped up with our rage?
I do think an earlier caller hit upon an idea, which is that don't forget that we're animals. And there is that notion that, yes, we have a higher conscious, but we also are slaves to our reptile brain. And we've evolved very quickly from being an animal into what we consider to be a superior being. But I don't know that we've evolved beyond our instincts. And our instincts are for food, for shelter, for safety, for preservation above all. And that instinct, especially for safety, for preservation, may be at the heart of this. And it's strange in a modern culture where we don't have to fight off saber-toothed tigers and we don't have to fight off the person who's trying to kill us at our doorstep for the most part. Those instincts still exist. Where do they go? They get sublimated and they express themselves elsewhere.
A rage so great. Habovi in Hartford, Connecticut. Habovi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to point something out. I was listening to these comments about the reptile brain and our instinctive impulse to war and rage. But I wanted to also mention that, you know, humans they have the distinctive quality of going to war with large groups of other beings, other creatures, other strangers that as far as they're concerned, have no personal affront to them other than some greater purpose declared by someone else. I think we're just the one distinct animal that does go to war. And I wanted to know what yours or maybe Mr. O'Hare's thoughts were on the fact that, you know, we can kill and rage and destroy entire civilizations of other people towards something greater. And I'm sure part of our reptile instincts are in there as well.
Yeah, we can build them and we can tear them down both. Our very social nature is sort of engaged even in war, Dennis.
That's a great point. And I do think we addressed that a little bit in the end of the play where, again, we don't give an answer. We simply reflect upon it. And our playwrights, our poet suddenly says, I don't want to talk anymore. I don't want to tell you about what happened next. I'm not going to continue. You can imagine it for yourself, the destruction of a city, of a civilization. You know what that looks like. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. Alexandria, all that knowledge lost, like Constantinople burning for weeks, like the Aztec temples razed, like Dresden, Hiroshima, like Sarajevo, like Kabul, like Damascus. And the point is that the going to the war as a collective group is a human phenomenon, and it's certainly not it's not a definite outburst of personal rage. What happens when you are collectively
magnified,
directed towards something? It becomes political rage or a political means or something like that.
Yeah, Chris in Watertown, Massachusetts, you're on with Dennis O'Hare.
Hello, Tom. Hi. I was fortunate enough to see an Iliad on Saturday, and the moment I think it's safe to say was one of the most memorable is the list of wars. It was, for me and my wife, a very profound moment. It was beautifully staged, moved me to tears, particularly when I started talking about the Indian Wars in North America in particular. But the start of that list kind of sneaks up on you, and once you realize what you're experiencing, feeling this list, it takes on kind of a separate life of its own, which kind of, you know, happens in part because of this spare spotlight, but just the nature of what you're talking about. And by the time it was over and the entire audience exhales, I realized that I had forgotten what the context of the list was. And we're talking a lot about that, and I just want to hear your thoughts on that. And you talk about the context of that.
Chris, maybe some of the list itself, because it's just a river. The wars, when you think the volume on and on and on, Dennis, we've only got 3 minutes and change, but give us some of that sense. It's just your poet taking us through that unbelievable litany.
He's trying to explain something, and he says, "It's if you'd seen it, the waste, just like, yes, there was one time... It was a terrible hot day during the conquest of Sumer. I mean, the conquest of Sargon, the Persian War. No, the Peloponnesian War. Wars of Alexander the Great, the Punic War, Gallic War, Caesar's invasion of Britain, Great Jewish Revolt, Yellow Turban Rebellion, War against the Moors in North Africa, Roman-Persian War, Fall of Rome, Byzantine-Arab War, Muslim conquest of Egypt, First Siege of Constantinople, Arab-Chinese War, Saxon Wars, Viking raids across Europe, Bulgarian Siege of Constantinople, Zand Rebellion in southern Iraq, Croatian-Bulgarian War, Viking Civil War, Norman conquest of England, First Crusade, Second Crusade, Third Crusade, Fourth Crusade, Children's Crusade, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th Crusade, Norman invasion of Ireland, Mongol invasion of Russia, Mongol invasion of China, Mongol invasion of Afghanistan, Mongol invasion of Vietnam, the Hundred Years' War, Chinese domination of Vietnam, Polish-Lithuanian Teutonic War, Hunger War, Fall of Constantinople, Wars of the Roses, War of the Priests, Muscovite-Lithuanian Wars, the Spanish conquest of Mexico, the Mughal conquest of India, War of the Two Brothers, the Spanish conquest of Peru, 30 Years' War, Pequot War, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd English Civil Wars, Cromwell's conquest of Ireland, Cromwell's conquest of Scotland, the 335 Years War, the French and Indian Wars, Second Cherokee War, American Revolution, French Revolution, Haitian Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars, the Bolivian War of Independence, Argentine War of Independence, Mexican War of Independence, Bolivian War of Independence, War of 1812, Colombian, Chilean, Peruvian, Ecuadorian Wars of Independence, Lower Canada Rebellion, Second Canada Rebellion, Second Seminole War, Mormon War, Patriot War, Honey War, First Anglo-Afghan War, First Opium War, Crimean War, American Civil War, the Sioux Wars, Second Anglo-Afghan War, the Boer Wars, Cuban War of Independence, Spanish-American War, Mexican Revolution, World War I, Russian Revolution, Third Anglo-Afghan War, Irish War of Independence, Afghan Civil War, Japanese Invasion of Manchuria, Saudi-Yemeni War, Spanish Civil War, World War II, Spanish Palestinian Civil War, Arab-Israeli War, Cold War, Korean War, Cuban Revolution, Tibetan Rebellion, Vietnam, Bay of Pigs, Sand War, Six-Day War, Laos, Cambodia, the Troubles, Prague Spring, Nicaraguan Revolution, Salvadoran Civil War, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Iran-Iraq War, Falklands War, Second Sudanese Civil War, the First Intifada, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, U.S. invasion of Grenada, U.S. invasion of Panama, Afghan Civil War, Rwandan Civil War, Chechnya and Bosnia-Herzegovina, Chechnya, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Iraq, Chechnya, Afghanistan, Rwanda, Darfur, Iraq, Haiti, Pakistan, Lebanon, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Congo, Gaza, Somalia, Georgia, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria.
It's like going over Niagara. Dennis O'Hare, it was powerful on stage, it's powerful with us right here, right now, war upon war. Dennis O'Hare busting out of Homer's Iliad there with An Iliad. Thank you for your performances. Good luck taking it on the road again, and thank you so much for being with us this hour, Dennis.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Dennis O'Hare, co-creator with Lisa Peterson of An Iliad on national tour later this year. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.